Part 4. Shout at the Devil. Chapter 1. Tom Zutaut. A wage earner in the employ of Elektra Records embarks on an adventure in which the discovery is made that a group of most ill repute has a manager of yet more dubious standing. I think that the only reason I ever succeeded was because of my passion. I always went beyond what anyone else was doing to get something I wanted. Like, when I was a DJ at my high school station in Park Forest, Illinois, I heard about a radio conference at Loyola University and signed myself up. It was there that I discovered I could get free records. Our high school radio station had been operating for years, and not once had it occurred to them that they didn't have to buy their own albums. My first job out of school was in the mailroom of the Chicago WEA distribution branch, a position I only got because I impressed someone at the label while I was on the phone begging for free Cars records. Eventually, that same passion earned me a promotion to Los Angeles, where I worked as an assistant in the sales department at Elektra Records, which at that time had acts like Jackson Browne, Queen, the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt, and 29 with Lenny White. I suppose if I wasn't enterprising, I never would have pulled over that Thursday night on Sunset Boulevard. It was early evening, and I was cruising Sunset hoping to get a bite to eat at a coffee shop called Ben Frank's, which was always packed with young rockers being served by 70-year-old waitresses who had been working there since the Lana Turner days of Hollywood, when I noticed hundreds of kids trying to get into a concert at the Whiskey. I looked up at the marquee to see who was playing, and it read, "Motley Crue, sold out." That same passion and obsession that led me to go to the radio convention at Loyola tugged on me, urging me to pull over when my stomach was growling with hunger. In the front window of a record store on the corner, Licorice Pizza, I saw a huge display featuring four glam-looking, leather-clad, androgynous refugees from the New York Dolls. I also noticed that they'd put out an album on their own label, Leather. For a band that didn't even have a record deal to be creating that kind of hysteria at the Whiskey was pretty rare. I had to see them. I walked up to the front door, pulled out my Elektra business card, and bluffed my way in, telling them I was an A&R man for the label. I was always trying to get the label to sign the bands I was into, but they never listened to me. I gave them I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett, which I found on the B-side of a European single, Tainted Love by Soft Cell, The Human League, and even The Go-Go's, and they passed on all of them. I was too shy to rub it in their faces, though. I felt lucky to even be working for a record label in Los Angeles at age 20. Inside the club, 500 teenagers, the club's capacity, were going berserk for this Motley Crue band, and they looked amazing. Nicky was so intense, it seemed like he would be in the streets killing somebody if he wasn't playing bass. He hit the strings so hard that he kept splitting the skin between his fingers. Watching him throttle that thing, with blood flying off his fingers, the strings seemed like razor blades. Vince was one of the best-looking and most charismatic singers I'd ever seen. Women's legs spread open just watching him sing. He was the exact opposite of the guitarist. Looking at him was like seeing Satan reincarnated, though he turned out to be the nicest of the bunch when he wasn't drinking. Tommy looked like an overexcited kid, but at the same time, he seemed like the only natural-born musician in the band. He was a high-quality drummer, a good showman, and constantly in motion. He seemed like the linchpin that held the whole thing together. After the show, I found their manager and told him that I wanted to bring the band into a meeting at Elektra. To my surprise, he completely brushed me aside. He told me instead to talk to Green World, a small local distributor that was handling their album. By coincidence, there was a music trade show in town and Green World had a booth there. I talked to a man named Alan Niven, who put me back in touch with the band's strange manager, an overly serious building contractor named Alan Kaufman. Before I got too serious with Motley Crue, I wanted to make sure I wasn't overstepping my bounds at Elektra. I asked the A&R department if I could sign the band, and they laughed in my face. But I was persistent. I put together a file with letters from the A&R department rejecting all the bands I'd brought to them that went on to have hits at other labels. At the urging of my boss in the sales department, I presented the letters to Joe Smith, the chairman of Elektra, who, to my surprise, rose to the challenge. "Okay, wise guy," he told me. "You think you can do this? Fine. Then let's sign this band and see how good you really are." I was the laughingstock of Hollywood for courting these guys. The music that was popular at the time was British New Wave, Haircut 100, A Flock of Seagulls, Dexy's Midnight Runners. Hipper kids were into Elvis Costello, The Clash, and other bands riding the tail end of the punk movement. Everyone kept laughing at me for trying to sign a metal band. They'd come up to me at work and say, "What are you thinking? This is not going to get played on the radio. You can't reinvent Kiss." But I believed in Motley Crue because that crowd at the Whiskey believed in Motley Crue. You don't need ears to be a talent scout. You need eyes. So, on my tiny sales department assistant expense account, I began wining and dining the crew, who I think only came along for the free food. During each meal, Tommy fidgeted madly. Just like on stage, he couldn't keep still. Mick became more demonic with each drink until he started hallucinating and seeing purple people eaters, and Vince usually fucked the waitress in the bathroom. Nicky was the only one who took the meeting seriously. He had mapped out each step for the band's future in his head. He knew that the kids were sick of New Wave, that they were angry at punk for having sold out, and that they were bored to death with Fleetwood Mac and Foreigner and light FM pop. He wanted to expand those 500 kids at the Whiskey into a national rock and roll revolution that Motley Crue was going to lead. And he did. But not without a lot of struggling. When we were finally ready to sign a deal, Virgin Records showed up out of the blue. They met with the band and brought a briefcase filled with $10,000 in cash to dangle in front of their starving faces. Virgin at that time didn't have a label or distribution deal in America. They operated out of England, and they tried to use that to seduce Motley Crue, telling them that they could be like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Led Zeppelin, and break into America by getting popular in England first. I think that was a romantic notion to the band. That, and the aphrodisiac of a $10,000 cash advance and a $100,000 deal. In the end, although Virgin offered about $25,000 more than us, the band decided that it would be smarter for a Los Angeles rock band to sign with a Los Angeles rock label. None of us knew that Elektra would soon be relocating its offices to Manhattan. After we hammered out our final points and agreed to sign the deal, Kaufman, the band, some Elektra staffers, and I celebrated at Casa Cugat's, a Mexican restaurant owned by the rumba king Xavier Cugat. Motley Crue didn't need much to start a party back then, so things got wild pretty quickly. The odd thing, though, is that I expected crazy antics from the band, not from their uptight manager. However, he got so drunk that he ended up speaking Vietnamese as if he were a soldier back in Nam. He became convinced that there were gooks hiding behind tables and storehouses of ammunition in the kitchen. He downed another shot, then ran into the bathroom. When he didn't reappear after several minutes, Mick asked me to check on him. I'd always thought of Kaufman as a by-the-book kind of guy who served as babysitter for this wild band, so it came as a shock when I found him in the process of ripping a payphone out of the bathroom wall. I pulled him away and asked someone in Elektra's press department to keep an eye on the band and pick up the tab while I drove Kaufman home in my beat-up company car. As we were cruising north on La Cienega, he kept trying to rip the handle off the car door. Just as we reached the center divide at Santa Monica Boulevard, he pushed the door open and rolled out of the car into the middle of the intersection. I looked back and saw him between traffic lanes, crawling on his belly like a soldier with a rifle. Cars were whizzing past him, beeping and yelling, and it seemed like only a matter of seconds before someone would squash him flat. I pulled over, ran back, and grabbed him. He started swinging at me and cursing as if I were a North Vietnamese soldier trying to capture him as a prisoner of war. I really thought that he might kill me. But through some sort of adrenaline kick, I managed to bring him back into the car and to his hotel room. By the time I got back to the restaurant, the party had moved elsewhere. A week later, the names on the contract were finally inked, and the band insisted on making the record label pay for another party. So, we piled into our company cars and took the band to Benihana on La Cienega. It began as a very civil dinner, with the chef showing off his knife tricks. The band ate some and drank a lot. Vince, of course, was drinking the heaviest. I noticed that his margarita glass was broken, so he ordered another one. When I looked at him again, the new glass was broken, and he was insisting on a replacement. The perplexed waitress brought him yet another drink, examining the glass carefully to make sure there were no chips or cracks. As soon as she walked away, Vince put the glass to his mouth and bit into it, shattering the edge of the glass. This guy is nuts, I thought. He could cut his tongue out or tear his lips to shreds. Vince stood up, signaled the waitress, and accused her of giving him broken glass on purpose. She swore up and down that the glass was fine when she gave it to him. Then she turned to me for explanation. I didn't want to get her or Vince in trouble. Maybe the dishwasher is broken, I offered weakly. So she brought him another margarita and retreated to the corner with the manager to spy on Vince. Unaware that she was watching, Vince sunk his teeth into the glass again. Instantly, the manager ran over and tried to kick us out of the restaurant while the waitress called the police. I quickly settled the bill and broke the party up. Most nights were like that with the band. Either something was going to get broken or someone was going to pass out. Nothing was ever easy with them. The head of A&R at Elektra, Kenny Batiste, was furious that I had gone over his head and gotten permission from Joe Smith to sign the band. So he did everything he could to make my life difficult. We were originally just going to re-release the Too Fast for Love album they had put out on their own, but Batiste convinced the label that the quality wasn't up to radio standards and the only way to put it out would be to remix it. I was against it, and the band was nervous. But if a remix was what it took to make the band a priority at Elektra, we were willing to play along. When they chose Roy Thomas Baker to rework the record, I practically wet my pants. Here I was, at age 20, meeting the eccentric British maverick who produced Queen, Foreigner, The Cars, Journey, and all these other amazing records. And though his last-minute mixing, phasing, and production tricks took away some of the raw charm of the original Motley album, I learned a lot by watching him work and hearing his stories. After the band spent the day in the studio, he'd usually invite them up to his house, where they'd be snorting cocaine off his plexiglass piano while he told them about the time Freddie Mercury wrote Bohemian Rhapsody at that very piano while getting a blowjob. RTB, as we called him, was a man who took great pleasure in throwing the perfect party. From Thursday night until Monday, there was a never-ending parade of interesting people, beautiful women, alcohol, and other party favors at his house. It was the ultimate producer's pad up in the hills on Sunset Drive, from the remote control settings on his bed to the thick shag carpeting. The sky was the limit there. 20 naked people packed into the jacuzzi, food eaten off women's bodies, and anything else you, I, or Caligula could imagine. Motley Crue and RTB were a perfect match. I always felt out of place, like a kid from Chicago who had somehow been transported into this glamorous movie where I got to meet all my favorite rock stars, Elton John, Rod Stewart, and guys from Queen, Journey, and Cheap Trick. Some parties were so besotted that RTB would push these buttons and lock everybody in. That way, if anybody wanted to leave, they'd have to get clearance with a security guard who'd make sure they weren't too drunk to drive. RTB was a smart guy. He knew that if he was going to facilitate this kind of mayhem, he needed to minimize the potential for accidents that he'd be held responsible for. And looking at the state some guests were in, he probably saved a lot of lives. As we were finishing the remix of Too Fast for Love, Kaufman suddenly decided to send the band on a tour of Canada, even though there was no record to promote yet. We protested and told him it was pointless, but Kaufman was adamant. We never understood why Kaufman made the band tour Canada until the truth came out in a lawsuit later. He had sold a portion of his stake in the band to a Michigan kid named Bill Larson, who had pooled his parents' life savings, about $25,000, so that he could own 5% of Motley Crue, Inc. In order for Kaufman to collect the money, he had to send the band up north to tour. So the band arrived in Canada to embark on a miserable, disastrous road trip with a co-manager they had never met or heard of before. There were bomb threats, border problems, fistfights, acid-addled hockey players, broken bones, mostly Kaufman's, and cops standing on the side of the stage at some shows to make sure the audience didn't kill the band. Soon afterward, Kaufman vanished, along with Elektra's entire advance and the poor Michigan kid's money. Perhaps he left because the band had started asking too many questions about where all their money was going. Money he probably felt like he deserved after mortgaging his house 3 times to pay for all the rental cars and hotel rooms and God knows what else the band had damaged. Ultimately, the person who was hurt most was Bill Larson, whose father died of a heart attack because of the stress. Larson sued, though no one was ever able to find Kaufman to serve the subpoena. From what I heard, Kaufman's wife divorced him, his kid stopped speaking to him, and he became a born-again Christian. When Elektra released Too Fast for Love, it was a disaster. The priority for the label was an Australian band called Cold Chisel, and everybody in the promotions department was intent on making them the next big thing. I happened to be listening in on a conference call when I heard a regional promotions man say to the head of the radio department, "Listen, I've got a station in Denver and another in Colorado Springs that just added Motley Crue. They're not interested in Cold Chisel, but I'll keep working on them." "I don't give a fuck about Motley Crue," the radio department head yelled back. "They're not a priority. I don't want those ads. You tell those stations that if they add Motley Crue, they can go fuck themselves." When I heard that, I hit the ceiling. It was bad enough that the label wasn't helping Motley Crue, but now they were actually trying to hurt them. So I blew the whistle to Joe Smith. Because of that incident and several similar ones, the head of promotions was replaced. Around the same time, Tom Werman came to the label as the new head of A&R. Werman had produced the first Ted Nugent album and some of Cheap Trick's best music, and he was so excited about Motley Crue that he insisted on producing their next record. He and Nicky were very much in tune. Nicky wanted a bad boy image, but at the same time had a pop sense and wanted his music to cross over into the mainstream, which is what Werman tried to do with the bands he produced. Despite the best efforts of the promotions department to sabotage the record for some mysterious reason, Too Fast for Love ended up selling more than 100,000 copies, all through word of mouth. I didn't know what to do because the band had a major label record deal, had sold a respectable amount of albums, could sell out any club in LA, were getting a buzz in the industry, and were beginning to write their second album, but they had no manager and were all broke and starving. I tried to take care of them the best I could. When I was 16, Lita Ford was the girl that I dreamed about. A total rock fox. I had posters of the Runaways all over the bedroom in my parents' house. Now, just 5 years later, I'd signed Motley Crue, and Nikki Sixx was living with one of the Runaways. And not only was I hanging out with them, but I was also giving them food and money. I'd stop by Nikki and Lita's house when I could and bring them Haagen-Dazs ice cream or a Subway sandwich. People always said that the pair of them fought like cats and dogs, but they were always fun to be with. As time passed, however, the house kept getting creepier. I'd drop in and see the Necronomicon, a black magic spell book, lying on the table. Nikki was getting heavily into satanic stuff and wanted to call the record Shout with the Devil. It was upsetting to the label, and it was upsetting to me. I knew the promotions department would use the title as an excuse to completely ignore the album. I went over one night to have a discussion with Nikki about changing the title. When I walked in, he and Lita were huddled on the couch. "I'm kind of freaked out," Lita said. "Weird things are happening in the apartment." "What do you mean?" I asked, looking around at the freshly painted pentagrams and gothic paintings that Nikki had on the walls and floor. "Weird things just happen," she said. "Cabinet doors keep opening and shutting. There are weird noises, and things keep flying around the apartment for no reason." "Listen, Nikki," I said, "you have to stop fooling around with this satanic black magic shit. It's powerful stuff, and if you don't know what you're doing, don't mess with it." But Nikki didn't care for grandstanding. "It's nothing," he said. "It just looks cool. It's meaningless symbols and shit. I'm just doing it to piss people off. It's not like I fucking worship Satan or something." I knew I couldn't change his mind, so I left. When I returned 2 nights later, there were forks and knives sticking in the walls and ceiling, and Nikki and Lita looked much paler and sicker than usual. "What the hell have you guys been doing?" I asked. "We aren't doing anything, man," Lita said. "I tried to tell you, stuff is just flying around here on its own." As she said that, and I swear to God I saw this with my own eyes, a knife and a fork rose off the table and stuck into the ceiling just above where I was sitting. I looked at Nikki and freaked out. "There is no more Shout with the Devil. If you keep shouting with the devil, you're going to get killed." You can believe what you want, but I truly believe that Nikki had unknowingly tapped into something evil, something more dangerous than he could control, that was on the verge of seriously hurting him. Nikki must have realized the same thing because he decided on his own to change the album title to Shout at the Devil. To this day, that incident remains one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen in my life. Fortunately, I soon met a booking agent named Doug Thaler, and he knew a guy, Doc McGee, who had a lot of money and wanted to start a management company. Doc was a charming little guy who knew how to say all the right things. "We're going to make Motley Crue the biggest rock and roll band in the world," he said. and whatever money Electra won't put up to make this happen, I will. Everything seemed perfect. Motley Crue had money, they had a guy named Barry Levine helping them with their image, and they became a record company priority. Thanks to Doc's masterful manipulation, generous imagination, and under-the-table gifts, Nicky was finally on the verge of moving his rebellion from the whiskey to the stadiums. But, of course, nothing happens for those guys without a struggle. I woke up a few weeks later to find out that Joe Smith had been fired and a guy named Bob Krasnow was running the company. He fired Tom Werman and replaced him with Roy Thomas Baker, which was fine because now there were even more reasons to go to RTB's parties and Werman still wanted to produce the record. But just as we were getting ready to record, Krasnow flew to Los Angeles and called Werman and me into a meeting. "Rock and roll isn't happening," he told us. "I've decided that I don't want any rock bands on the label. I wouldn't take Ozzy Osbourne if you gave him to me for free in a silver platter." "Why would you drop a group who are selling lots of records? That doesn't make any sense, Bob." "This is Elektra Records, Tom," he said. "We have a tradition of fine, talented acts like Linda Ronstadt, The Doors, and Jackson Brown. I'm not in the circus business, and I'm not giving them a penny. Their managers are willing to take care of some of the promotion and touring costs." "Listen," he said, "the group is just awful. I saw their video, and it's embarrassing. I had it taken off MTV. "What? We just lined up a tour for the band with Kiss. You can't do that." "I heard about that, and I've canceled the dates." I called Doug Thaler and Doc McGee in to meet with Krasnow, and he told them the same thing. They responded by asking him what they needed to do to release Motley Crue from their contract with Elektra. "I'll tell you what," Krasnow relented. "You make the best record that you can make. Don't worry about money, but keep the budget reasonable. I won't promise you that I'll put it out, but I will promise you that I'll make it easier for you to take it someplace else." If they had been dropped then and lost the momentum they had built up, it probably would have been the end of Motley Crue. But fortunately, something happened to change Bob's mind. And that something was the US Festival. Less than a year later, Krasnow would be dressed in a Motley Crue bandana at Madison Square Garden, presenting the band with awards for gold and platinum album sales.